hear the voice of Carrie Johnsrud. This is from her CD Beyond the Neighborhood, the music of Fred Rogers, collaboration with Kevin Bales. She was on the show a couple weeks ago, but we didn't, Dan and I realized, Dan Long and I, that we didn't play enough of her music. There's her voice. There you can almost hear. There she is. It's a pretty amazing CD. A few weeks ago, I was at an event, a benefit for a wonderful film society in Chicago. And there was an auctioneer there, as there are at many benefits, and we started talking, and he was such an interesting, captivating guy that it made me realize who goes up to the auctioneers at an event and says, "Hi, where are you from? What do you do beside this? How did you become an auctioneer?" His name is Jim Miller, and he's in the studio. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rick. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Your background, you're a kid from Michigan who initially got hooked on this crazy business, didn't you?
It was my first love.
Why? Why and how?
I think when I was a kid, I used to, they used to call it DXing. You know, late at night, you'd flip through the stations looking for these, and in Michigan, you could pick up a WGN.
Sure.
You'd pick up, New York stations. And I just fell in love with that one-on-one conversation. I really bought into that idea that announcer was talking to me.
Was it a little transistor under your pillow?
It really was. Yeah. And I just loved that. And so in my hometown, there was a little radio station, a little 3,000-watt FM station in Howell, Michigan. And it was just a natural. They were, you just walked in the door and said, "Could I do something?
Can I have a job? Can I be a DJ?" Yeah.
And they were like, "Sure. Yeah, go sort records and, look at all the stuff." And you just get sucked into it. It's fun. And the next thing you know, you're getting, "Hey, we need a voice on this commercial." And then eventually, somebody says, "Hey, we need somebody to do the noon to 6 o'clock shift on Christmas Day."
And why did that not become your career?
I kind of fell out of it. This was in the late 80s is when I started. In by about 95 or so, the radio consolidation, just the jobs dried up to a great extent. Mm-hmm. A lot of these medium market stations were all of a sudden, you didn't have you had a live morning guy.
And then feed from...
Coming in from Dallas or wherever.
California.
And so I think I just kind of, I just moved on from it. And I went back, I did a little jazz show after a couple of years and did it. So, I enjoyed it. I mean, to this day, I love it.
How did you find the auction world?
Well, it came from the radio thing. It was about that same time in the late 80s, early 90s that these benefit auctions kind of became a thing. There's not a tremendously long history with these, and what you found is a lot of these PTAs and PTOs at schools were looking for an alternative way to raise money.
Sure. What were they doing before? They're doing like casino nights and bake sales and car washes and
pizza. Hey, we're doing frozen pizzas. We're selling calendars. We're doing all these things. And quite honestly, this was the same time that most of these events are run by moms.
Sure.
And they were getting back into the workforce in a very quick manner, and they just didn't have the time. And they said, "We're getting nickeled and dimed every 4 weeks. It was something different." And there was just kind of a deal made. And they said, "Here's the thing: we'll see you on the third Saturday in May. Bring your checkbook. We're going to raise a ton of money for the school, and we won't bother you the rest of the year."
Do you remember your first auctioneer?
I do. Yeah.
What was it?
It was for Spencer Elementary School in Brighton, Michigan. And I had no idea what I was doing.
What were the items being auctioned?
Oh, goodness. There's always been kind of a common thread when it comes to the items. And I always tell clients, I'm like, there's only one question you ask. Do you think you can get two people to fight over it?
Yeah.
That's it. Doesn't matter who donated it. Doesn't matter what you tell me it's worth. Get two people to fight over it. You've got an auction. And so I think we had some vacations. I think we had, maybe some sports tickets back then. But I had, what I was told was, start low and go high. That's it. I didn't have any kind of a shtick or anything.
Did you study at all? Did you?
Where? There was no radio.
Idiot's Guide to Auctioneering or something?
No. This was pre-internet.
It was all seat of the pants.
It just was. And I've always applied a very simple concept to these events. And even now, whether I've got, 200 people in the room or 1,000 people, which is that it's a really small percentage of people that are ever going to be buying these items. You've got maybe 4 or 5 items to sell in the live auction. So you've got, 4 or 5 winners.
Yeah.
You might have 350 people in the room. So my approach has always been entertain everybody. Mm-hmm. And then you'll just kind of clear a lane for those five or six people to do
that. I'm glad Jim Miller used that word entertain, because there are some auctioneers that we have seen through the years that are auctioning off horses and cows.
Sure.
And blah, 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 blah. That is not what you do, and that is not what most auctioneers do. There are those, that level of pro.
Right.
But then there is the auctioneer as entertainer.
Yeah.
Is that how you see yourself?
Well, I work exclusively in the nonprofit sector. So every one of my clients is a nonprofit. So it's a different mindset.
Why is that?
Why do I work with it?
Yes.
You know, it's kind of where I started, and I liked it. I liked the warm, fuzzy feeling, quite honestly.
Yeah,
and it's gotten even more so now because I'm able to make a bigger impact. And regardless of the client, I mean, in the last week, I had a client on Tuesday night that, you know, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but I'm not far off. We probably had 125 people in the room. We probably raised $25,000, $35,000. And that will mean that organization gets to stay in business. They get to continue helping youth in Chicago.
So there is some, I'm going to ask you this, there is some altruism in your profession.
Sure.
I mean, that obviously is one of the elements that keeps you going.
I try to make room for them. I try to make room for them on my schedule. And then, you know, 3 days later, I'm at Navy Pier with 1,000 people working for the Cubs.
Yeah.
So last night,
let me read something. Someone sent me something 31 minutes ago, a guy named Dan Durbin. He said, tell Jim Miller hello from Dan Durbin, a guest of yours about 8 years ago on your morning show. Jim was the auctioneer again last night at Envision Unlimited at the Four Seasons. He is the best in the country, and he will always be our auctioneer. Tell me about last night, Jim.
It was great. We had this is just a
what is this organization?
So Envision Unlimited is a great organization that works with adults with disabilities in helping them find houses, helping train them for jobs, integrating them into our communities. And I've worked with them. I think it's been about 7 or 8 years now, and they're just a great group. And we had a fantastic event last night over at the Four Seasons.
How many people?
I got to think about 400 people. So it was a great room and just a fun room. People that care deeply about it. And you know, I'm the guy they're asking them to, you know, for their money.
Well, but also you're now, after 7 or 8 years, you are their a featured performer. I mean, people must come up to you and say, hey, it's good to see you again.
It's awfully nice to hear that.
Yeah, yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah. You do get it's funny because you do get a little bit of this, you know, and let's not overplay it, but you get a little bit, there's some auction junkies out there.
No question.
That just dig it. They love it. And they love that fast talky thing and joking. And, you know, I've had people that are like, you know, I'll be over at this table. You know, if you're looking to pick on somebody,
yeah,
you know, if you want to have a little fun, come on over to mine.
That's the thing that distinguished you the one time I saw you. It was a kind of you were kind of beyond pleasantly playful is the way I want to put it. Pleasantly playful. We'll get into the particulars of being a professional auctioneer. This is your profession.
When someone
says, what do you do? What do you say?
I tell them I'm a fundraiser, and I only do that because if you tell people you're an auctioneer, the next question is inevitably, Hey, could you do that fast talky thing for me?
Exactly.
And as you said,
I'm a cow. Pretend I'm a cow. Exactly. Pretend you're selling me and I'm a
cow.
But
I'm an auctioneer. Yeah. I mean, that is, I'm licensed and that is what I do. But I like the entertaining part to me really is just an offshoot from the old radio.
Yeah, no question. No question. That's what makes you so good. We got to take a short break, during which I'll tell you, come on out to WGN-TV's White Sox Weather Day this Tuesday. See Skilling's presentation, followed by the White Sox versus the Indians. Tickets available at whitesox.com/WGN. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Jim Miller, my guest, is a auctioneer. That is his profession. That is his livelihood. That is, I would dare say, Jim, your passion, too.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of information. You got a nice website. It is charityauctioneer.com. But we're going to probe now. Do you make a good living doing this?
Yeah.
I don't want figures.
No. Here's the thing is, you know, when you work with nonprofits, at some point in time, there has to be a return on investment for that.
Sure.
And I've always believed that if I'm going to ask for a dollar from a nonprofit organization, I'd better be able to bring them three or four.
Yeah.
And so a big part of what I do and what I try and offer is to be able to work with him well in advance. You get to see me for 20 minutes, do the auction.
Also, one of the great things about your website is you have a sort of, factless. What somebody, if you are out there, ladies and gentlemen, one of you is saying, you know, now that you mentioned, maybe we should have an auction for our operation, for our charity, for our business. The thing to do is do it in a sensible way, to sit with you before saying, hey, I think I'll hire this guy, Jim, and just wing it from there. Right. There are a dozen things that people need to know before they go in. What kind of microphone they have, number of different things. And so you're sort of a
there's a consultant aspect to it.
I don't like
the term, but, you know, again, that 20 minutes that you see, that's what makes my phone ring, and that's great.
Sure.
But it's the 7 months in advance that I'm working with the team, and it's always a smaller team than you'd like to have, trying to come up with those items.
Give me an example. What's the biggest mistake that people will make going into setting up an auction, trying to raise money? Some of the biggest mistake may indeed be saying, all we need is the auctioneer, and we'll get prizes from our friends.
Yeah, I think the biggest mistake that I see made over and over is putting too much emphasis on what they consider to be the value of the items they're getting. So I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Somebody will say, well, my best friend owns the local Persian rug store, and he's going to give us an incredible 75-year-old Persian rug. It's worth $15,000. In a live auction setting, on a Saturday night at the Radisson, with a bunch of people that came because they care about the XYZ Foundation, the chances of us having two or three people
who love Persian rugs,
needed that size Persian rug,
have $15,000.
It just doesn't happen. Yep. And so I have one simple, and I talk to people about this all the time. Ask yourself one question. Are you confident you can get two or more people to fight over this? And the emphasis is really on fight. It's got to be. I got no beef with the White Sox, but until they're back in those winning ways, you don't have to fight to get tickets to see that team play.
Point.
So you go with whoever it is that's hot. And in 2005, we were blowing them out, and there were a lot of years where you couldn't get money for Cubs tickets, and it gets soft when the Bulls aren't winning. And so if you can just ask yourself, can I find people that really want that item, that makes a good one. So I always tell them, I get it. We want to raise a lot of money, and I know that $15,000 looks good on paper, but the reality is you're never getting that $15,000.
Don't you find, and you must, because you go to 10 times as many of these as I do, and I have been to plenty, but when it comes to auction prizes, even silent auction stuff, and especially with live auction prizes, it is kind of the usual auction suspects.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, a week in Acapulco, a foursome at Medina.
Right.
It seems to me, an utter lack of creativity. And I guess, and I don't know if you've seen it, maybe people just have that kind of expendable dough in order to help the organization. They'll pay $5,000 for a foursome at Medina, but
sometimes they will. But that's a good enough example. And Medina is one of the greatest golf courses
Absolutely.
In the country.
Yep.
But golf is not what it was 20 years ago.
True.
And while it's still not a course that I'm going to get invited to join,
likewise.
So people will want that opportunity to play it, but they're just not paying what they used to, and so it's tough because when you get that donation, almost always from a member, they don't want to talk about how it's not worth what it used to be worth. And so they're still telling you it's worth $5,000. But the reality is you're probably not going to see that.
Well,
but we try and make it create. I mean, the best items that I've ever saw, I give you an example, is, you know, we did this Cubs event this past week. And obviously they have access to some tremendous, you know, there's nobody else out there that can offer you a, you know, get inside the scoreboard experience.
Sure.
That's cool. They had 51 empty wine bottles. These bottles were opened after every win during the 2018 series. At the end of the game, they win, they break open a bottle of wine, and Joe Madden would get out a silver Sharpie and he'd write some notes on it. You know, and he'd put on the, you know, Lester went, you know, 7 innings, you know, 9 strikeouts, you know, 7th inning, you know, KB hits a grand slam. Just puts little game notes on it. And they saved them.
Why? Why do you think he did that? Do you think he did it with a note, or is he just nuts?
I think Joe loves the game. He loves the psychology. He loves the history. I think it's a memory thing for him.
Wow.
This is a one of a kind. You can't get this anywhere else. 51 empty wine bottles, and we put them out there. You can't get this anywhere else.
Correct.
I don't know. I think we sold it for $13,000.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
How did you
phrase? And I had four people come up to me and they go, these are just going to collect dust in somebody's den. And I'm like, yeah, but where else are you going to get something?
How did you pitch that item? When you pitch the item, ladies and gentlemen, this is unique.
Yeah.
Joe Madden is kind of nuts and he writes on all these wine labels.
A little bit.
And you can own this.
That's it. And that's the unique thing. And it can be a couple of years ago, we did, you know, similar types of things with, you know, we had for Kerry Wood, I did some work with the Wood Foundation, great organization.
Yeah, that is.
And we decided for the 20th anniversary of his 20K game, we said, well, let's go out and get a baseball signed by every person he struck out. And so there weren't 20 players. There were a couple guys that just had a bad day.
Yeah, right.
There were a total of, I think, about 11 guys and a couple of them multiples. Well, not all these guys are Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, quite honestly, I don't think there's no great secret. I mean, you know, we probably spent $250 collecting all these balls on eBay and calling in some favors and put them in a beautiful frame and they put in a baseball glove and, you know, a couple of autographs, everything else. And again, you know, somebody in the room that believes in that organization, that really wants to help them, there's a pretty good chance that they came into that night thinking, geez, I'd like to donate $10,000-$15,000 to this cause. And then I like to think that at some point during the process, they go, or I could buy this really cool piece of memorabilia.
Which is, in a sense, a donation.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's exactly. Well,
an item being unique, obviously, is the
it's the
greatest
best.
Thing.
It's the best.
Do you know before you go into most of these what you're going to be auctioning off live?
Yeah.
I don't mean like 5 minutes before.
No, but that's that process. That's the months in advance. I mean, I literally, you know, I've got four auctions this week, and I know what I'm selling at every one of them. And we've been talking about it and that constant feedback with the organizations.
And you will step up and say, look, I just don't think.
Absolutely. It's part of my responsibility. Now, they don't always like to hear that.
Of course not.
You tell somebody on the committee, hey, I know your best friend's the rug dealer.
The Persian rug dealer.
But what I want from the rug dealer is, you know, his box seats for the Bears, if he's got those. Because you have to be able to, and they don't have to listen to me. And you know, many times that happens.
So this is creative for you before and during the fact. After, I'm assuming people just go, hey, great job, as these people are writing notes to me. But before and during.
Yeah.
How do you get up for these things? I mean, it's very much, I think, having seen you, a performance piece in essence. Yes.
Yeah, you get that rush. I don't, you know, I think it's the same as coming on the radio.
You pretend you're on the radio.
You do. You just, you know, to me, I mean, that's the, you know, I have a lot of friends in radio still. And, you know, it's ironic because a lot of people in radio like the idea of being in a room with four walls and not having to face people.
Yeah, right.
And I've always been the guy that says, oh, hang on, if you got 1,000 people out there, let me go talk to them. And so that's just been a little bit of it. But yeah, I mean, you just, you know.
And knowing the size of the crowd before we take a break, if you're doing it in 200 is relatively intimate, 1,000 is a stadium, like I would think. How does your attitude change to that? I mean, are you more gregarious, more extroverted? Do you turn that on?
A little bit. You have to. It's a bigger room. It's a little bit tougher to get everybody's attention. That's the trickiest part. It's a little less intimate. It's a little tough to go out into a room of 1,000 people and you know, work one-on-one. But you do what you can.
You have a fascinating job. We're going to continue on with auctioneer Jim Miller. You can read all about him at charityauctioneer.com. And we'll ask, the whole field is interesting because it's got to be a very competitive field.
It is.
I think it is a very competitive field. So please stay tuned.
When the day turns in.
Fascinating CD called Beyond the Neighborhood, the Music of Fred Rogers. Yes, That Mr. Rogers. It's her collaborative effort with Kevin Bales. I have a few more minutes with Jim Miller, who calls himself an auctioneer, but I call him a producer and performer. I think that better captures you do help produce these events, these very serious events, though you make them lighthearted and fun to raise money for the nonprofits for whom you work. You've been doing it since 1989, starting with an elementary school, and now you do everybody. It's got to be a pretty competitive field, though, Jim, because there are increasingly competitive because the philanthropic community, as we were just talking before the show, is kind of shrinking in a certain way where now it's like, oh, I can just go online and give money to these people, right?
Yeah, the way people give has shifted a lot. And there's a lot of really good people that do this. When I first started, there were, honest to goodness, there's probably 20 people in the whole country that were able to say, all we do is the nonprofit stuff. Yeah. There's always been somebody at, you know, Hart Davis Hart. There's always been somebody at Leslie Hindman. There's always been somebody at those cars and cattle auctions. And they're always willing to donate their time and to come in and do it. And so for me, it was finding that niche and saying, hey, if I'm going to work with the nonprofits, you got to work with them in advance, help them get things right. These are always understaffed. I can't think of a nonprofit I've worked with in 30 years.
Where they have their annual benefit producer.
It's easy to keep track of who's on the team. It's usually three or four people at the most, and many of them it's one person. It's an extraordinary amount of work. I mean, these committees are always driven by volunteers.
I mean, I get the feeling you really like that creative challenge too.
I do. They're thirsty for knowledge. When I walk in, and many times I'll meet with like a board, and you know, here are these people that are on a board because they care about this organization, but nobody was brought onto that board with a pre-qualification of having auction knowledge. Many of them have it.
Sure.
But to have somebody come in, there's nothing better than having a bunch of people in the room that have great contacts. Maybe they've got money. Maybe they've got influence, and to say, here's what I'm looking for. You know, I remember years ago when I told somebody when the Grateful Dead came and did their last show, I said, hey, I think that's going to be a pretty hot concert. These are going to be tough tickets. And, you know, but I think it's sold out. And I, you know, 3 hours later, I got an email and they said, oh, well we got the tickets.
It's all they think it's sold out.
Yeah.
We called Jam Production.
Somebody always knows somebody.
It just seems, and one of the great things about you, getting to know you a little better, is you were terribly enthusiastic about what you do.
I love it. I really do. It's an absolute joy from very early on in my life. I was told, like I think a lot of people are, love what you do. Find something that you enjoy doing. Now, I was doing radio, and of course, I became fabulously wealthy doing small market radio.
Everybody, yes, Dan and I are rich, and
big
Ro Coleman's got tons of dough. She just likes to come in and produce this show on Sunday.
Big money. But yeah, it's a fantastic feeling to know that you can help these organizations just a little bit. There are a lot of people doing a lot more work.
Also, also for you, and I saw it happen at at the Chicago Film Archives benefit. There's a reward for your ego too, is there not? Because you are an absolute entertainer.
No, there's no question. Yeah, I mean, I am at the very bottom. I mean, I'm not even the most famous Jim Miller in Chicago. Yeah,
that's true. Do you ever use your name to get free drinks? Yeah, I'll never forget that touchdown pass that guy dropped. Yeah.
I will tell you one quick story. Jimmy Buffett came to town a couple of years ago, and I remember getting the email. I'm a big fan of his, and it said that he was playing at the House of Blues. And I said, well, that's just an April Fool's joke. Something's right. He's not playing at the House of Blues. And of course he was. Yeah. He was doing these little in-between shows. And so it sold out immediately. And I made a phone call about 3 days before the show, and I called and just got the box office and talked to a young girl, and I said, hey, I said, I know how this works. And a couple days before this show, somebody's going to release some tickets, and I just want you to know that I'm interested. So I'm going to give you my personal phone number, and please don't share this with anybody.
Yeah,
but I'm going
to
give you.
Because we used
and you
to do
call
that
me.
Before the Bears game.
Right.
I'm just telling you that. That's how I know this. Yeah.
And I said, when these tickets come available, please give me a call. I just need one ticket. I'm going to come in. I'm not going to cause it. She goes, okay. And I give her my phone number, give her my name. And about 20 minutes later, my phone rings. And it's some guy.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Miller, hey, we just wanted to check in. And just like, we absolutely have got a ticket for you. And
you got some free drink tickets for
you. Not once did I misrepresent who I truly was. And it's the only time I have, at the end of the conversation, I went, oh, they definitely think I'm the other Jim Miller.
But one of the great things, I think, I think I would recognize on sight Jim Miller, but I'm not sure I would. Dan, would you? The Bears quarterback?
You see him on TV on occasion. Well, he went to school at Michigan State, and he's
if you can share stories.
I'm a little older than him, but I mean, there was a time when, you know, I was playing high school football, and you know, there was a little confusion, but not for long.
Close enough, man. Close enough. Jim, it's really a pleasure to get to know you. You're going to be back on here too, because you should come in someday and just talk about when you've got a lot of upcoming auctions to try to get people coming to the auction, because you work for nonprofits nonprofits sort of quietly make this city run.
Well, I know there are very few of them that don't benefit from the generosity of this radio station and the organization, and on their behalf, I thank you guys for everything that you guys do to help them. So.
Anytime. I'll try to get you a podcast on this show. I think you'd be good at that, too. Go to charityauctioneer.com and look in your Chicago Tribune in the coming weeks, because Jim is such an interesting guy, and I am full-time a writer for the Tribune, that we're going to do a story about this. The fascinating world of non-for-profit auctions. Great to see you. Great to get to know you, and carry on.
Real pleasure. Thanks, Rick.
We'll take a little break, and we'll talk to Ina Pinkney about something she's got going on. Welcome back. There is an event taking place this Wednesday that involves two of my favorite people on this planet at one of my favorite places on this planet at the Lakefront Restaurant, which is a theater on the lake at the foot of Fullerton at the lake. A dear woman and legendary chef, Ina Pinkney, will be interviewed by the Lakefront Restaurant's executive chef, Cletus Friedman. Ina, it's a pleasure to have you on the phone. How are you?
Well, I was reminded that the last time we were together, I came to the studio, and after getting up at 4:30 in the morning for so many years, I discovered there was an 11 p.m. at night also.
I remember meeting you in the parking lot. We were in the Tribune Tower then and wandering through the bowels of the Tribune Tower to come up to the studio. It would have been nice to see you, and I'm hoping to come to the event on Wednesday. You know, before we get to the event itself, Ina, you know, one of the things that I'm reminded of, you opened Ina's Kitchen in 1991, and it became... Sure. It became not only Chicago's premier sort of breakfast joint, but also it really was among the pioneering restaurants in the whole culinary explosion that is the city of Chicago. Am I making too much of that or not?
No, I think we changed the landscape of what breakfast was supposed to be, and it was a fine dining place. And all I can tell people when they ask me about that, that there is great power in being underestimated.
And your joy in doing it, though, and I think you're also, you have proven to be a real mentor to a generation and a half of chefs who have come here to... Let me ask you first, Ina, does the explosion... And I can't go 2 seconds without hearing from somebody, hey, did you hear about this new restaurant? Did you hear about this new restaurant? Did you hear about the James Beard Awards? Did you hear about this? And is this good?
It's really good for the city. What I worry about is the lack of really good kitchen help. And so everybody is struggling to find good line cooks and good prep cooks. And so it worries me that the kitchens will not be able to sustain. That's my biggest fear, because I speak to the chefs and I know how they're struggling.
Well, though the chefs are really good, I worry too, because I think there's a sort of, you know, star system going on here that anybody who decides, well, I'm going to go to culinary school because then I can have my own restaurant and my own television show. And I think that that's unrealistic. I think there are a number of jobs in the restaurant business that are satisfying on their own without the trappings of stardom.
That is very true. And if you have any DNA that says hospitality in you, there are so many ways to use that. I also tell young people, save your money. Don't go to culinary school. Get a job as a dishwasher and be the best dishwasher you can be, and watch the prep cook, because one day the prep cook is not going to show, and you will say to the kitchen boss, you know what? I can walk over there and I can take care of that. And while you're doing the prepping, make sure that you finish fast and clean and then go over to the sandwich station and say, can I help you? What are you doing here? And you want to learn how to get to the top? Do it from the dishwashing station up.
How did you get to the top, Ina?
Well, I called myself the breakfast queen. I went right to the top that way. I never baked my first cake until I was 37 years old, and I opened my restaurant at 48, knowing what I was doing.
I know.
I haven't got a clue.
That's why your story and your book, Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen, that's what we talked about the last time you were on the show. I just found one of the great life stories in the history of Chicago, whether in restaurants, banking, or the mob, for goodness sake. Do you miss the day-to-day at all, Ina?
You know, I don't miss it. People ask me about that all the time, and it's really not so much the labor. I mean, if it was about the food, I hit a home run every plate.
Sure.
But it's really about facilities management. It's about all the permitting, and it's about keeping things going. You know, I always said that I had two jobs in the restaurant. One was to fill it up, and the second one was to metabolize anxiety, so that no matter what was going wrong anywhere, walk-in cooler, a leak in the basement, run out of toilet paper in the men's room, I had to make it look like there was nothing wrong. I could just handle it all, and you were going to walk in and have a great experience.
Yeah, that would beat a person down. Now you have, I have to assume, you've been to the lakefront restaurant already.
Oh, it's so beautiful, and Cletus is such a remarkable chef. So to know that he's going to be talking to me, and we've known each other for many, many years, so all will be revealed, Rick, all. He will ask me questions, and I will have no choice but to tell the truth.
You're going to give away recipes?
I am, and he's going to make my famous chocolate blobs, and we're going to make some other food from the book, and people will be eating while we're talking, and he's going to pair it with some drink. So I think it's going to be a fun evening to learn everything. Like, people will find out the answer to the question, Ina, did you really dance with Fred Astaire? And the answer is, yes, I did.
Good. So now people want the intimate details. That's why I know you'll tell me anything, Ina, but I think you can be more expansive, especially in the face of light food and a drink pairing throughout the evening. The other thing about, I wrote about that place before it opened, when I went there certainly as a kid when it was Theater on the Lake, and they do have theatrical presentations there, but I must tell you, I share your opinion that there is not a cooler, maybe not on a night like tonight with rain, there is not a cooler, more distinctive restaurant venue that I can think of, certainly in this town. Usually you think, oh, well, something on the 90th floor would be fantastic. This has an intimacy with the city that is, I would have to say, unrivaled.
Well, and looking at the lake and then turning your head to the right and looking downtown at our skyline.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable place to be, whether you're inside or in the summer sitting outside. It's unbelievably beautiful.
Now, how do you know Cletus? I find him to be a very interesting character, too.
He is. I can't remember when we met, but it was one of his first jobs in Chicago. And as you said earlier, I always introduce myself to the chefs and tell them I'm available for you to talk to anytime because I know your world.
Yeah.
And, you know, that has come back to help me because I'm home now recuperating with a broken leg, and all the chefs have been sending me food.
Oh, my God. Is your leg?
I know.
Wait, I'm going to ask you: is your leg really broken, or did you just tell?
Yeah.
Telling chefs that it's broken?
No. Oh, that's good. I didn't even think.
It's not a bad idea. It's not a bad idea.
I should have called you sooner, but then I wouldn't have had to fall down and break my leg.
Good old devious Rick Kogan. Good old devious
that would
Rick.
Be you and me, baby.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. When are you going to be well? Obviously, you're ambulatory.
It's been 4 months, and it's a very slow slog. That's all I can tell you.
Oh, and I'm so sorry, but I'm glad you're getting out Wednesday. Ina Pinkney will be at the really astounding. If you've not been to the Lakefront Restaurant, it is. This should be your introduction. I think it could be a wonderful introduction to hear.
Right.
This remarkable woman. I'm hoping you're going to have copies of your Ina's Kitchen memories and recipes from the Breakfast Queen, aren't you?
I will indeed have them. And my favorite part of all of this is when people come up to me at the end and I have a chance to talk to them one-on-one. There is nothing better than that. That's the one thing that I miss about the restaurant.
Yeah.
And lucky for me, I actually get to see a lot of my old customers. I'll tell you one quick story.
Sure.
I was in the waiting room having physical therapy over at the new Shirley Ryan Rehabilitation, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and a woman came up to me, and she said, "Oh, I heard you fell, and I'm so glad to see you, and I was an old customer of mine, and Ina, it's just so great to see you." And a man puts down his newspaper and goes, "Ina's here? Where's Ina? I have to see Ina. Where is she?" And then another man pops up, and he goes, "So what am I, the only person who doesn't know her?"
How funny.
That's so good.
How funny. Well, you must. I mean, that must be one thing, too, whenever you go out, and you were, and I hope you do it some more, you were writing with some regularity for the Tribune about Breakfast.
I do it monthly, yes. Usually the third or fourth Wednesday of the month, I'm in the dining section, and a column called Breakfast with Ina, and I go to three restaurants and just tell you about the experience. I am not, it's not a critical food review. I only want to write about places that are worth your time and your money to go.
Well,
and
that,
there's no firewall. There's no firewall on it, so you can Google me.
Well, but there's no firewall at the Tribune? That's fantastic. That's almost unbelievable. That's almost unbelievable to me.
I know.
And your book, I mean, you are, I'm a huge fan of the column, and in a way, it is, you say it's not a critical column. It's not adversely critical, because it is critical. You're talking about places that you like and admire.
Yes, absolutely. The food has to be excellent, and the service has to match the food. And then I will tell you where to go. And I have really great restaurants in the last few columns. I thought I might run out, but I haven't. And it's only about weekday breakfast, Rick.
Yeah.
I'm not a brunch girl. Brunch is not my beat.
Why not?
Oh, it's too busy and fussy, and I don't know. Give me a good breakfast Monday to Friday, and I'm a happy girl.
I agree. Ina, it is great to talk to you. I hope you heal very, very
Thank
quickly.
You, darling.
I think Wednesday will go a long way. The weather's supposed to be really nice. It's not supposed to be like tonight. Because someone's saying, would you like her to come in the studio? I go, no. First of all, it's miserable. It has rained every night of this program.
Yes.
It's going to be beautiful on Wednesday night. It is just take a cab. I prefer cabs to Lyft and Uber, but take a cab, or there's parking there too. It is at Fullerton and the Lake. It is
will
one
you,
of them.
Will you tell people the phone number to get a ticket, please?
Sure, I'll give them the website, because no one has phones anymore.
Even better.
It is theateronthelake.com. You will find all the information for Wednesday night's event. It's
you're a good man, Rick. You're a good man.
Stop it. Admission includes light food with a drink pairing throughout. There's the key for me. I know. Throughout the event, doors open at 7. And the interview between where Cletus Friedman, I have the feeling that Cletus will indeed grill you a bit, but you too, Ina Pinckney, will grill him too, because he's a fascinating guy and he's done remarkable things with that menu. It's a great looking place, but it's a really good place too. Ina, fix that leg. Don't keep going to the rehab place to meet your old customers. Get out and have some new breakfast somewhere. It's always a treat to talk to you, sweetie.
Thank you.
Take
so
good care
much.
Of yourself, doll. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. What a nice woman. She really did invent this whole crazy breakfast scene in Chicago. She's such a mentor to young chefs in this town. She's responsible for turning this city into the culinary capital that it is. We got to take a commercial break, but coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Welcome back. We have changed this studio to a version of Russian Tea Time. Russian Tea Time exists at 77 East Adams and has been in existence for more than 25 years. I have been there over the years a number of times. I don't know why I would see it. and it would look so homey and warm that I would go in. I didn't meet or know the owners until about 3 weeks ago when I went in there for your celebration of, I think it was 25 years. I am so pleased. It's a unique Chicago treasure. And one that is extraordinarily popular, but I think not as well known as many restaurants in this town, because I think the people who have owned it and the new owner partner, one of them is also here, work too hard to go out and make the gossip columns. That's what it is. I have in here, and I'm so happy to be joined by the founding family of this, Sergey and Clara Muchnik. And their son, Vadim. Clara and Sergey, you came to the United States from Uzbekistan?
Yes.
In what year?
We came 1990.
Why? Because you could come, right?
We could come. We can come. The door was opened for us to come. And we want a more nice future to our children, our oldest daughter, Jana. She's in New Jersey with her family, and Vadim. Vadim was 17 when we came to the United States.
You never thought he'd grow up and be a nice young man and have four kids, and you now have seven grandchildren.
Yes.
Why
yes.
Chicago?
Jewish Federation accept us to Chicago.
And you, as I understand it, I don't know much about you. Not a lot has been written about this amazing place that you worked in Russia as a surgical nurse, but you
yes.
also, when you were a nurse, and your husband, Sergey, was a doctor, yes?
Yes.
But as a nurse, you started, you loved to cook, and so even in Uzbekistan, you were catering parties, right?
I'm joking, it because of me.
What do you mean?
I mean, the problem was when Clara came to Uzbekistan, she had only one uncle with family relatives.
Oh.
But I was born in Tashkent, capital city of Uzbekistan, and I had a lot of friends and a lot of relatives. And when we invited for some celebration, we need to invite 50, 60 people. And Clara, step by step, because of her mother, greatest cooking skills, she understand how to cook, to prepare for 2-3 days everything from start.
Wow.
And step by step, she developed such skills.
Well, that's, in many ways, that's a very good way to learn how to cook,
yeah.
Don't you think?
But to be not...
So when you come to Chicago, did you speak English?
No, I knew only 10 words. And for me, I think the biggest victory, even not restaurant, I can talk.
Did you learned a little bit by watching television, right? That seems almost impossible to me. I think of myself going to a foreign country and trying to learn the language by watching TV shows.
The first half year for me, I'm talking about me, was, you know, just a river with water. I cannot understand even one word. But we start to listen, and how to say, to understand each word, each sentence. And
We decided at home to speak only in English, even if we don't express ourselves in the right way. We try to speak English.
Now, Sergey, what did you do when you came here? Did you go to? Did you both get jobs immediately when you came?
We were very fortunate. We love them. We didn't know what will be with us, what we will do. We just, as any immigrants, were ready to come to do any job, to clean the apartments, how many immigrants doing, and actually with Vadim
partnership was
we clean apartments together.
Somewhere.
But we were very fortunate. And Sergey, he's not only MD, he's PhD, biochemistry research, which he likes this one, it's his life. And after first
interview,
after 1 month, he was accepted. And Hectoin Institute.
For medical research.
Wow.
Yeah. We were very fortunate, yes.
Wow. When did the idea of starting a restaurant occur to you? And Vadim, what were you doing as a crazy 17-year-old there?
That's right. So my very first job in America was
working as a busboy at one of the Gold Coast hotels.
Which one?
It used to be called Double Tree.
Yeah, sure.
It used to be called Guest Quarters Suites Hotel.
Yeah, all these hotels right down here have changed their names 40 times.
Exactly. I was part of the opening team as a busboy, and that was how I tried my first chance in hospitality. Mom's first job, other than cleaning apartments, was working in the Jewish Deli on Michigan Avenue. And
which one?
It used to be called 332 Deli.
332 Deli.
On 332 South Michigan.
Yeah, sure.
She was started as a cashier. No.
No, oh, I maybe. Just come to wash the dishes because I didn't have any language. Just thank you.
See, this is, I must tell you guys, the Muchnick family, as well as the new partner in this, Alton. Is Alton?
Yes, it is.
What's your last name?
Montoya.
I don't want to mispronounce it. And I can't. Wait, she's much younger than anybody in this studio. She may be about Dan Long's age and maybe Roe Coleman's age, but I want to. We got to figure out how she became your partners. But I just want to tell you before we take a short commercial break that you guys exemplify the best of the immigrant experience. I mean, this is, you remind me you're much, 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 much younger, but like my grandparents, who also came here from Russia many decades before you arrived, and this whole notion of starting simply.
With anything, right?
I mean, do you feel a sense, I don't want to get too deeply into, we could spend the whole hour talking about immigration, but you must feel a, I don't know if you feel a sense of pride or this is just what you had to do.
You know what, in I will tell a little short, of course, in Soviet Union, when you are a doctor, you are very VIP.
Sure.
On the top, and I was surgical nurse, but it's not easy to survive for family.
Salary was not like an American salary.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. We were paid less than workers. Yeah, and to and survive, we need to find some additional
jobs. I want to continue why I start to do catering, because it was easy to hard to survive. The best thing in our life, we love Soviet Union, our motherland, and we love United States. But the best thing in our life was our two wonderful children, our daughter, Jana Kleinerman, with her family, she's in New Jersey, and our son, Vadim. And this was the best what we had in our life. We didn't have house. It was extremely hard to survive. So we always start to find out something, you know, to survive. So Sergei, actually, he is wonderful biochemist. He had students, and I like to cook. Not how Sergei say. His family made me cook.
No.
I start to cook. He like to say this. It's okay. I accept this. But how to say? But I like to cook from 7 years old. Really like.
Yeah.
And I did this. And so when I got married, I was not perfection, but I can to do. I can do Russian borscht.
Well, I know
something
you,
else, yes.
I'll tell you this. I know so, you can cook now.
Yes.
I present it like joke. That's
conversation.
And that's why I start to think, help a little bit the family to survive, and I start to cook.
Well,
for
you
weddings
help,
and catering.
You certainly help the family thrive here. We have to take a little commercial break, and then we'll come back and start to talk about how, of all the places in the city to start a restaurant, it seems to me that in the middle of the loop would be like the craziest place. We'll figure out if you were crazy were
100%.
Smart. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I'm here with the downtown version, the Riverside version of Russian Tea Time, one of my favorite places in this city. It should be yours, 75 East Adams. If you've ever been to the Art Institute or the Chicago Symphony, or you've seen the place, I guarantee you have walked by. If you have not gone in, it's a terrible, terrible mistake. I'm talking to the founding family, and what they've been talking about is the definition of the immigrant experience in this country as it has been for 100 and some years. Clara, Sergei, and their son Vadim Muchnick, their daughter, is somewhere else. They have 7 grandchildren, and they have a new partner. Etienne could you, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And try to, am I wrong in saying you're Russian as well?
No, I'm Turkmen.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Okay. So, but tell me about your feelings about, I'm not making too much of their story about the immigrant experience, am I?
Well, you mean what I think about their
Yes,
success.
What you think about their, you know, what they've done.
It's actually amazing. Yeah. I can't even imagine how, for example, Clara, how she used to manage all of the accounting, all of the purchasing, and all the stuff. Front of the restaurant, back of the restaurant, and on, like, I don't know, it's unbelievable.
Now, you and another young lady have become new
yes.
partners in this. How did that happen?
It's actually thankful to my brother, Batur. He found that place, and he was like, oh, you know, that place seems very nice. We can talk to their owners, and maybe they want to be... maybe they need
partners.
Were you and your colleague interested in the restaurant business?
Yes, we actually interested in food business.
In food
yes.
in general. Food
yes.
in general.
Right.
What did you think then when you and your colleague first walked into the
had
you,
my family?
Oh, family. When you first walked into the place,
it was very warm and very how to say. Unique place.
Yeah.
And it is something that is very close to our culture and to our food, what we used to eat back home.
Sure.
And it was like, oh, I like this place, I like this menu, I like all of the dishes, and let's talk about...
The icing on the cake was these people, right?
Right.
And it was like, yeah, I like the food, I like the place, but man, I like these people.
And after it was, we met with Clara, and we just loved her. She was so warm and like my grandmother, and it was just like connection.
Vadim, when did you get it? No, we haven't even... Thank you so much for telling me about your feelings, but we haven't even started like, okay, you're working in a deli... You're working in the medical profession, Sergey.
Yes.
And Vadim, you're a crazy teenager working at a hotel
working
down
three
here.
Three shifts.
Yeah, working three shifts at a hotel. How does the idea and the wherewithal and the Vadim, when she's patting him on the shoulder, how does the restaurant, how does Russian Tea Time begin, Vadim?
So, absolutely. So, mom started as a cook, prep cook in this Jewish deli. Then Peter, her boss, threw her on the cash register, and she's like, Peter, what are you doing? I don't speak a word in English. And he said, you'll figure it out. He was all this short staff. It was probably a blessing in disguise because that's where mom's hands-on English learning began.
Just forced to learn. Yeah,
yeah. Forced to learn. And he loved her. She would make simple tuna salad, and he would be like, oh, my gosh, I've never tasted this tuna salad. And she told me, mom told me, she says, Vadim, they're pouring the iced frozen soups into a can, warming it up, and they're serving it, and people are...
Oh, it's okay. The place isn't there anymore.
Exactly.
For Clara, it's like, oh, my God, don't say that.
Yeah, it's not anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's not there anymore.
And
don't worry.
People are loving it. Says, if only I could cook for the public, I know I could do so much better. At that time, I was finishing my associate degree in college. I thought I already understood business.
Degree in what? What were you getting a degree?
Accounting from Robert Morris College.
Okay, right and downtown. Everything you guys do is in the loop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I thought I understood the front of the house operations as a busboy. And I said, Mom, let me help you open your place. And after
daily.
A year or two,
first
we wanted to do the deli. And after I help you start it, I'll continue my studying. And that's how the idea was born. But we could not get a single landlord to talk to us because they all said, well, we have Einstein Bagel and Sklosky's Deli. Why would we take...
Well, I'll bet in some ways when you went to these people and said, we want to start a Russian restaurant, there wasn't much. There was some, my grandparents being Russian, there was some kind of Russian presence here, but it was not, let's say, the hot restaurant trend.
Exactly, and that's exactly how it evolved from the deli idea into Russian restaurant, because we had to differentiate ourselves so the landlord could say, okay, this is a unique opportunity, there is no one to compare it to, and that's how the idea evolved into the Russian
establishment. Without getting into a lot of details, you certainly had to raise some money to open a restaurant. I have to believe that opening a restaurant on East Adams Street was a little more expensive than opening a restaurant in Rolling Meadows or someplace.
For sure.
Why did you decide on why that location, 77 East Adams?
Yes, because I was working 330 to Delhi on the Michigan Avenue.
Right.
Michigan and Jackson.
And she liked it downtown. She only wanted to be in downtown. That's it.
Well, that's good. That's a sophisticated...
For 3 years, I knew each corner of downtown. I was so impressed with downtown. So
And Clara, the amount of people and the people, I mean, that had to be part of
all
it, too.
The
crowded.
Yeah, and Vadim a little bit forgot. He told me, Mama, what you are going to work all time for Peter. He is wonderful. Or another Peter. You have so not bad skills.
So much talent, yeah.
So much talent, and you have to think something about it. I say, don't tell me anymore. Mm-hmm. When we were in Soviet Union, my catering was popular, and not only I, all my family, daughter, Vadim, Sergei, I was busy, I didn't see what kind of weather outside. Sometimes I forgot in which level of school.
My mom was so busy, she didn't know what grade I was in.
Yes, one evening I asked them what grade. And
do you go to school? Yeah.
Yeah.
What? So I'm sorry, and we were lucky with this idea of Russian restaurant in downtown close to symphony orchestra because of New York's Russian tea room restaurant.
They were definitely our inspiration for us.
Chicago clients were so impressed with this idea. We were so lucky that even in first days, restaurant was full of people and line was staying outside.
It is such a confident, the confidence and ambition combined is so...
And a little bit of craziness. Like you said, you had to be crazy. We were 3 years in the country.
How would you get a bank loan?
Can I interrupt you, please?
Yes.
The problem is that because I was working in research, Clara was working in Delhi, but all negotiation with a constructor, with lawyers, with everybody was done by our son. He knew English.
He knew how to play the game.
And everything was because of
him. He can impress everyone.
He was only 19 years old.
He's impressed me.
So you asked about the investors. We took a very expensive loan, extremely expensive.
I'll bet.
And that was the risk that many immigrants take, because we have to start from somewhere,
scratch.
And we had zero.
And the biggest craziness was that we opened it in
1993,
when it was a recession. We didn't know what it meant.
Yeah, what's recession? We're new here.
Let's go. Yes.
Right, this is a great story. We have to take a commercial break, and then we'll continue on, because I do eventually want to talk about the food you serve, which is really astonishing. I have a great friend who thinks you have not only the greatest Moscow mules in the world, the greatest tea she has ever had in Chicago, and she loves tea, and these chicken croquettes, I think she would eat for every meal, including breakfast.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I am not drinking vodka here tonight, but I am so taken with the story, the history of Russian Tea Time at 77. It may look like a restaurant, but behind every restaurant that has been around for a while is a wonderful long story. I wrote a story in it not long ago about the Artist Cafe, which just closed at the
Fine Arts
Building. Yeah, which was there for 60 years, and there are great stories behind every restaurant. One of the stories I have in here, the Butchnik family, Sergei and and Clara, who the patriarch and matriarch of the family, and their son Vadim, as well as Alton Manteva.
Yes.
Close enough. Who is a young new partner. The place is going to be closed. You still have time to go there. It's at 77 East Adams. Go to RussianTeaTime.com. It's a lovely website. But they're going to be doing some remodeling. Instead of, they've been around for 25 years, and they're going to close for the later part of the summer to kind of to refurbish and re-energize for the next 25 years. Because Alton and her sister, who are going to be involved in this thing as new partners, they certainly have 25. I don't have 25 years left to be going there, but they certainly do. It's for a new generation here. When you finally opened, you were locked in a freezer. Is
yes,
this correct?
Was, you know, it's, can I tell a little bit the whole story?
Yes.
I was
but
so,
that's not enough of the story, yeah.
I was so scary. It was, the restaurant was already done. And people around the Michigan, who passed away, they even showed dollars in the window and say,
open already.
And they say, open the door.
We're hungry.
We are hungry. They are hungry, and I'm scary. And Vadim say, Mama, tomorrow we have to open 29, September 29. I was so scary and crying. And he say, Mama, I love you so much, but you become more terrible than Stalin. It's exactly what.
Wow,
now.
What a nice compliment. Hey, happy Mother's Day.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And he put me in freezer.
I put you in freezer.
You put her in freezer.
Her husband put her in the freezer.
And Papa, he won't open the door. He say, no.
She needs to come
down.
And
I was crying, and finally... we second day really opened the restaurant.
No, but before opened, somebody knocked on the door.
Can I tell you who this person was? Do you remember Andrew Patner?
Absolutely. Incredibly
in
well.
May he rest in peace.
The late Andrew Patner.
It was his father, Marshall.
Sure.
So late.
And Mama, yeah. We know
right.
Him very well.
He was the first person who walked into the door because I said, tomorrow at 6 a.m. we're opening. And then Andrew came shortly thereafter. He and Tom are very good friends.
Yeah, that's when I was there. I
they
saw
were
Tom
dancing
there.
At, right, they were yeah. dancing at my wedding.
Wow.
Andrew, yes.
Wow. You also got an incredible amount of, and I love this, an incredible amount of support. Instead of jealousy from other restaurant owners in the loop, the guys who owned the venerable Miller's Pub, the Gallios brothers, came over to wish you good luck, right?
Yes.
And present any help what we need, they will help
they
us.
They told we will help you.
Italian village.
And in the beginning, we tried to figure out, you don't know how many people will show up, we would run out. Of
or
napkins,
bread, or
bread,
eggs,
or sour cream, eggs,
or butter.
We would run, and they would just give us no problem. We want to return, and they're like, "Don't worry about it."
That yeah. must that must have made
very
those
special.
First weeks and years.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
Not many waiters, and when a cook waiter, some waiters came to dining room and asked who ordered pelmeni, how people showed their hands.
You when have you mistake make, because yeah. was not enough employees.
Now, yeah, you folks okay. can take a look at the website, which is RussianTeaTime.com. Let me ask you, though, was there any kind of, did the Russian Tea Room, the famous Russian Tea Room in Manhattan on 57th Street, right next to near Carnegie Hall, that's a pretty famous place. Was there any kind of legal, hey, you can, what are you, got people nuts? You can't call it that. What?
There is actually a great little story. About 3-4 months after we opened up, our original name was Russian Tea Cafe. We got the letter from the attorneys, fancy letterhead, saying that the Russian Tea Room is concerned that it's creating confusion because one of their dining rooms was called Cafe. And we said, we don't want to disrespect. What should we do? And their attorney said, just change the name to a propose.
Wait a minute. They had a nice attorney?
They yeah,
wow.
exactly.
Well,
all the New York attorneys are nice, of course. So we proposed a couple names, Russian Tea House, Tea Time, and they agreed to either. So we chose Tea Time because I was always a big fan of afternoon tea. And it actually was probably... meant to be, because we were able to capitalize on afternoon tea since then.
No question. I do think there are probably people who think you know, I don't know. Elton, do you think people think of those two places as kind of sister restaurants?
Actually, do. Some yeah. people come in and they were asking, maybe the travelers or whoever been in New York, they were asking, are these the same, like, the same owners, maybe?
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, in the big scheme of things, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can go to one here and one in New York. That's that's fine. In putting together, and you people can go to the website to see what the meal offerings are. In many ways, you, the chef, Clara, you have to sort of teach the Chicago hot dog eating, deep dish pizza eating crowd, and in part of the menu is to instruct. Try this. If you like this, you'll like this and like this. Yes.
Yes. Number one was teach the people who work in kitchen, and I decided to be very international. So we were only one people, our family from Russia, and kitchen still. People worked with us 25 years and was from Mexico because they know how to cook. But first one, I didn't know English and they didn't know English. So, and Vadim still saying, Mama, how you got everything in the restaurant? What we had this 25 years. So they're all wonderful. Their children was born when they were in the restaurant. And they make the food. What, honestly, some Russians cannot make the food.
Wow.
Honestly, blins, strudel, stuff. Many Russians, they cook very well. But they're Mexican. They never did this food.
Because of your recipe.
So I control everything. I teach them everything. First one, I have to teach them. And after this, how you say, come to the dining room. And many people from the beginning still come to us. Many may be gone from life or what.
I'm sure.
And but, I know customers what they ordered from first day till today.
What are the...
Same thing. They fell in love some Mr. Fredkin.
Chicken croquettes.
Chicken croquettes, Pojarsky, our regular customers from the beginning. He always, Mr. Fredkin, if he listen now, ordered only Pojarsky.
Wow.
And his wife, Mrs. Fredkin, ordered only stuffed cabbage and samsa. It's from Uzbekistan.
And the most important thing in the restaurant business is to save the same taste for many years.
Exactly. No, that's true.
Her biggest achievement that she keeps the same taste. People, when come to restaurant, they remember taste for many years.
Yes, it's sort of imprinted. It's
yes,
imprinted
yes.
on them. How many kinds of, not that it matter, how many kinds of vodka do you have there? When I went over there, seemed like a lot.
52 different kinds of vodka and
about
Vadim.
12, 14 we infuse in-house.
It was his idea.
In fact, today we brought 3 infused vodkas.
Roger Badish, do you hear that?
I just joked. Horseradish.
Number one popular.
Is yes, the I most do. Popular? I hear it.
Yeah, it's Vadim's idea.
Black currant tea. So it's the tea that your friend enjoys so much.
Yeah,
we made. We infuse it. We infuse vodka with it, and also
she hasn't had that. She'll now become an alcoholic. Now
exactly.
She and thinks also, you have the finest tea that she has ever, and she's a tea aficionado ever tasted in the city of Chicago. She also loves the chicken croquettes and. The Moscow Mule.
Of course. What
is the most popular meal? I don't know if it is there one meal that is the most popular meal?
I can say you. The number one sale and most popular was stuffed cabbage and bistroganov. It's number one sale. And of course, what is really popular, and the menu made I. And I remember when we have to open, we were seated with Vadim in the walk-in freezer, and he describes the menu as a nice book, and I gave him ideas. So, and what I did good in the menu, big selection of vegetarian dishes.
Well, we have to take another break, and I will finish off this show by keeping these nice people here all through until 11 o'clock again. All you need do is go to RussianTeaTime.com. The restaurant is going to remain open until about the middle of June, and then it's going to close for a kind of, not so much a remodeling as a reinvigorating and refresh with, because new partners, Alton and her sister, right? Your sister,
yes,
right? who didn't come in today, but these young people are, I mean, we'll talk a little about, you know, she obviously loves you guys,
and you love her.
That's kind of the best partnership I've ever heard of. We're going to take a short commercial break and come back and talk some more with these fine people. I have only a few more minutes with these fine, fine people, Clara and Sergei Muchnik and their son Vadim. They also have a daughter. They have 7 grandchildren, and Alten Manteva, who with her sister are the new partners in running Russian Tea Time at 77 East Adams. Vadim, you were talking about the early days of this place and about, you know, the Loop has had its up and down years, and there have been, and the places that remain, the places like Miller's and the places like Russian Tea Time have seen the ups and downs. You were talking about like a couple homeless guys.
Certainly. We actually have made many friends, and even mom, although she's retired, we have people who run into me on the street and say, please say hi to mama. Aww. She always took care of me. There is one story I want to share is when there was a gentleman, his name was Mr. Pops. He was invalid, you know, he was limping very heavily and would always have a cane. And he always say, hi, mama, hi, papa, he called my parents. We always took care of him, bring out the beef stroganoff out. And he was so protective because, you know, unfortunately, there were many people who were hustling on the street.
Oh, sure.
At that time, panhandling. And he would stand in front of the restaurant and say, you cannot, these are my friends, you cannot hurt them. And true story, he would, one time there was a gentleman who was not together. He started fighting with Mr. Pops. He was twice as larger than him. Pops was defending us with his cane.
Oh.
True story. Another story, there was a gentleman, his name was Willie. He was down on his luck, homeless gentleman in his 40s. He was selling streetwise by Bennigan's, if you remember.
Yep,
he used
sure.
to be Bennigan's. We became friends. We decided to participate at the Taste of Chicago.
That Bennigan's is where Michael Jordan took his first wife on their first date.
Mm-hmm. Very good, yes.
Yeah. Should have, if you'd taken them to the Russian Tea Time, they'd still be married.
That's right. So we participated in Taste of Chicago. We were short of people, and the first person I thought of was Willie and his son Derek. I still remember. They were working with us. He says, Vadim, this is the first job I had in like 3 years.
Good.
It was a great story.
See, that's what I said earlier in the show, that there is really a great and detailed story behind every great. It is so hard, the restaurant business, that so many of them fail within a year or two and just vanish. But there's a good reason some places are able to stay. I think of the Artist Cafe down the street that I wrote about. I think of the Miller's Pub that I've probably written about a million times. And in the Loop, the other place is Russian Tea Time. Now, you two, Sergei and Clara, 25 years is a long time to be in the restaurant business. Are you tired?
I wasn't tired physically. And I like to work, I like to cook, and I like to control. Everything was under control.
Yes, Vadim is laughing
yeah,
now. Yeah,
if I come and to dining room.
And Sergei is laughing.
When
yes.
I come to dining room, look on the ceiling.
Everyone looks at the ceiling. What's wrong with the
when
ceiling?
When I look on the floor, everyone look on the floor. And but I was always, to be honest, maybe 15 years, I was always scary. I knew we are popular people, like restaurant, who will open the door. And I will always look at the door, who will open. And people in the beginning was a lot of mistakes, but Americans, thank God to Americans. They pick up our business.
Yeah.
They gave us good name. And I forgot what they were saying.
It's okay,
so emotional.
What I'm getting the thought with in your meeting, Alton and her sister, that you are partnering with people who you share the same philosophy. You share the some of the same tastes, and you're putting it into, you're sharing it with people whose hands you are confident will continue, because this is a, it's a legendary place. You can't just
thank you,
know,
you.
And Alton, you must feel that. It's, it doesn't seem like a heavy responsibility you and your sister have, but a, but an enjoyable one, yeah?
It was a bit, actually, honestly, it was a bit hard and scary.
It was scary. But having...
But they were very supportive, and they still support us, and it, it helps us to learn. The way we learn, it's easy, because we also, we always can just call them and ask if...
We still remain part owners, minority owners.
So I think that's smart, too.
Yeah, we have a good support.
I think that's very
nice. Very nice family, and nice mother family. And father, very
and,
beautiful.
And you said we are actually kindred spirits.
Yeah.
We're from Uzbekistan, they're from Turkmenistan. We're Jewish, they're Muslims, but we're like brothers, you know.
See, that's, you know, that's
we have
the
shared values.
Boy, that's the way the world should work, I'll tell
you. Shared tastes for life and shared tastes for food.
Yeah.
Sure. And for hospitality.
And what about vodka?
you asked what sealed the deal.
Yeah.
What sealed the deal for Alton is our vegetarian selection. She's vegan. The Russian tea time is a nirvana for vegetarians and vegans.
Yeah, no kidding.
So yes. That's I eat there.
She eats
I
there.
Eat there every day, so...
Yeah, well, well, the great thing is you'll be eating there. You're going to close from about the middle of June until roughly, you know, the beginning of September.
Yes.
And then you'll be eating there every day for the next 25 or 30 years.
Exactly.
That's the thing.
Exactly.
I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to meet you and get the story behind that amazing place. It is often frequented by people who certainly go to the symphony and people who go to the Art Institute, but it is a kind of loop landmark at 77 East Adams. And to hear the story of you know, the sort of triumph of the immigrant... You know, a lot of people think the American dream is gone. You guys are a perfect, perfect example that it still exists. So it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm going to see you. I'm going to come there in August and make you all come there and tell me more stories. I want to see the freezer that they locked you up in.
Clara. It's still here.
It is? I want to see what it was like when you were locked up in the freezer. So I cannot thank you enough. Alton Mentivaya, who is a new partner along with her sister with the founding family, Sergey and Clara Muchnik. It's an amazing story, and their son Vadim. What's your daughter do?
Our daughter, her name is Jana, and she has three daughters.
She's a pharmacist.
She's a pharmacist.
And, the medical part of the family.
Yes, okay. And our oldest granddaughter, her daughter, she is both Sori, Rebecca, and she graduated Rutgers University.
She was 6 months when we came to the States.
Yes.
Wow, it's an amazing story. It is a real honor to meet you folks.
Thank you. We're really very privileged. Thank you.
Oh, you're not. Don't
so
feel
much.
Privileged. It's a great story, and it's
thank
one that should
much.
Be told, and I will tell it again in what is called a newspaper. We're going to take a break. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. We'll be right back.
The numbers are in.
WGN Plus is where Chicago comes for podcasts.
Here's what's going on with WGN Plus. You feel like you're just an arm's distance away from something real? Well, Behind the Curtain found one thing that makes you feel alive with the play, The Djembe, where the audience gets to bang on a big old drum. FDC Studios tells the Corner Store about their creative process, and Getting to Yes And is trying to avoid those unspoken agreements we tend to get stuck in with friends and coworkers. Look them up. WGN Plus on iTunes and Google Play.
Hi, this is Wayne Messmer of the Chicago Wolves hockey team. We're honored to partner with Heartland Blood Centers to impact the lives of tens of thousands of people in the Chicagoland area and beyond. For the Wolves, leaving blood on the ice for our fans is normal. But we also have many fans out there that need you to give blood the safe way. By donating with Heartland Blood Centers, we challenge you to be a hero and save lives by hosting a blood drive or by personally donating blood. It's important to our friends, families, and neighbors, and it's important to me. Heartland Blood Centers save lives every day and supply blood to nearly 60 hospitals throughout the Chicagoland area and northwestern Indiana. They rely on the generosity of blood donors like you to continue their life-saving mission. For more information about hosting a drive or to make an appointment to donate, visit versiti.org/IL. versiti.org/IL. Or call 1-800-7-2-GIVE. On behalf of the Chicago Wolves, thank you for saving lives in our communities.
Get prepared for the peak home buying season with the Home Snap app. With the most up-to-date real estate listings and statuses, again, it's called Home Snap, and it's a free download online at gethomesnap.app.
Today's technology makes things a lot easier simply because everything is connected. Your cell phone's connected to your tablet's connected to your smart TV. They're all connected to your Wi-Fi, but it may only take one weak link in all of those connections for criminals to get in. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection added the power of Norton Security. While LifeLock uses proprietary technology to detect possible threats to your identity, like your info for sale on the dark web, Norton Security helps protect up to five of your devices from online threats like ransomware. And if there's ever a problem, they've got dedicated agents to work to fix it. Now, nobody can prevent all identity theft or cybercrime or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock with Norton gives you more protection for today's connected world, and who doesn't need that? Join now. You're going to get 10% off your first year. Just head to LifeLock.com. Don't forget to enter the promo code LifeLock. That's promo code LifeLock at LifeLock.com or 1-800-LIFELOCK for 10% off the first year. Get LifeLock.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. Dan Long, thanks for this extraordinary engineering job. Ro Coleman has become the new producer of this show. Ben Anderson has moved on to, he's still here. He's doing more all over the place. And I'll explain all that, and we'll see, get an interview with Ro next weekend. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.